The Conservatives are the largest party. They don't have an overall majority at this stage. The Prime Minister called this election because she wanted certainty and stability. This doesn't seem to look like certainty and stability.
Welcome to Polling Politics.
This week's episode is sponsored by Newgate.
Hello and welcome to Polling Politics. Every week, Marie and I round up the key political stories and statistics of the week, and we're also joined by a top guest from the world of politics to delve into the polling and public opinion in more detail. Our guest today is the journalist Anoush Shakalian. Hello, Anoush.
Hello, hi.
Anoush is senior writer for The New Statesman and the new host of the New Statesman podcast.
So we will have to kill her at the end of the episode.
She's also written for Time magazine, The Daily Telegraph, The Telegraph magazine, The Sunday Times, Total Politics, The Pool, Huffington Post, Trinity Mirror, Southern Local Newspapers, and On the Box. What is On the Box?
On the Box was one of my favourite ever jobs.
Tell us about it.
It was a website where I just got to review TV programmes and films all day.
Oh, nice.
Oh, right. That sounds pretty
great.
Good.
I don't know who read them. Don't even know if the editors read them at that place.
It was a great job. What were some of your favourite things to review?
Because I was so junior, they used to send me to all of the rubbish stuff. So one of my favourite things was this terrible Danny Dyer film that went straight to
DVD. Is there any other cut?
And I tore it apart and the director got in touch with me. He was so hurt.
Wasn't Nick...
No. And actually, I've been really regretting it ever since the renaissance of Danny Dyer and how
what
everyone
renaissance
loves him
of Danny
now.
Dyer? Danny Dyer is on the record as being a misogynistic arsehole and is still a misogynistic
arsehole. Yeah, but his daughter won the nation's hearts last year on
don't
Love
care.
Island.
And she's called Danny as well.
Exactly.
Still don't care.
So, you know, I'm waiting for that review to resurface at some point and for me to be cancelled.
Which director was it? Was it, what's his name, Nick Love?
I can't remember the name. I'm sure I've got the very wounded email that he sent me somewhere in my inbox.
Am I allowed to share my Danny Dyer anecdote? I'm very excited to have one as a foreigner.
Does everyone have a Danny Dyer anecdote?
But I used to live in Bethnal Green and one day I woke up properly earth-shatteringly hungover. And
Lying next to Danny Dyer?
Oh, God, no. Jesus Christ. And I was like, I need to leave the house, otherwise I'm going to die. And so I did. And then I was like, shit, I need to buy some food before I get to the cinema. So I was in my pyjamas with a Tesco bag with like toilet paper and stuff like that on my way to the cinema in Stepney Green. And I was like, for the love of God, why are there so many people here? And so I just kind of like elbowed my way past. I was like, I just want to go see Thor. Turns out it was the premiere of some Danny Dyer movie. So I literally looked up at some point, again, in my pyjama holding Lou Rule. And there was just Danny Dyer on his like kind of red carpet. And just like, I don't care. I don't want to know. And so I just walked past him and I elbowed past him and went to see Thor. There you go.
If you haven't heard the DVD commentary that Danny Dyer and I think the director Nick Love did for one of their films, it's on YouTube and it is certainly something to hear. Those are two very angry, very angry men. So check that out. Worth remembering that Danny Dyer, of course, did joke about cutting an ex-girlfriend in the face so that no one else would want her.
I did not know that.
I didn't know that.
Oh yes, yeah. This was.
Should have put it in that review.
This I think was for Zoo magazine. He then apologised, saying that it was only intended as a joke and never intended to be published. He didn't deny saying it. He only said that the mistake was it being published. So he is an absolute scumbag. Anoush, you're here to discuss other things other than Danny Dyer.
Yeah.
Danny Dyer, as we should call him in honour of the Mark Kermode and Simon Mayo podcast. But speaking of... actually, not speaking of anything completely unrelated
There's no segue
to that,
for that.
Boris Johnson. He is, it looks like, according to all of the, quite literally all of the polling, and it's not often you can say that, according to all of the polling, it looks like next week he will be announced as the new leader of the Conservative Party, replacing a clearly demob happy Theresa May, if the footage from the cricket is anything to go by. I'd like to kick off by asking you, who is the real Boris Johnson?
It's a really good question, and I don't know if we'll ever find out. I mean, even if he becomes Prime Minister, which, like you say, seems very likely, he does bend with the wind, as we've seen with Brexit. I mean, people seem to have forgotten that he wrote two columns, one in favour of Remain, one in favour of Leave, before the campaigning for the referendum even began. And obviously, in his leadership campaign, he's hardened and hardened towards the I'm going for a no deal. Brexit, which during the referendum campaign, lest we forget, was not the default position of Brexiteers. So he just goes further and further down the path of public opinion. For him, public opinion right now is the Tory membership public. But I wonder if that public definition will change when he becomes Prime Minister and he'll want to appeal more to the wider country. We should hope so. We should hope that he takes that route. And actually, knowing Boris Johnson and how fickle he is, he may well change his stance. But at the moment, it looks like he's really trying to appeal to that base still while the election carries on. I mean, I was speaking to someone who is a Tory MP, who was a Remainer, who is actually now a Boris Johnson supporter. And he was...
Yeah,
I know.
There are these people.
I understand.
And he was
absolutely convinced. It was like he was convincing himself. He was saying, well, look, you know, you have to make these statements. You have to make these sort of threats to have some leverage when it comes to negotiating with Europe once you become Prime Minister. So that's what this summer is for. I felt like he was really... Have you heard that from MPs?
Because I say on that sort of note, that reminded me, like, I've had a few chats with Tory activists, kind of like Tory, like, backroom people who are very much with the centrist end of the Conservative Party normally, but who are backing Boris and seem absolutely convinced. Because, you know, they've joined the Boris campaign, they sort of, like, say and tell themselves, because actually he's quite easy to influence, and they're like, you know, we actually want to be there, so, you know, we have the entire sort of, like, party represented, because actually he can be swayed quite easily by the people who talk to him, and it's like, how are you saying this? Like, it's a good thing? Like, you know, I'm busy joining the campaign because I'm pretty sure he'll just listen to anyone and kind of trust them. And it's like, that's not a plus. That should not be a plus, I think, in a potential
Prime
Minister.
We've seen that with Donald Trump. Like, the thing about him is that he listens to the last person who's spoken to him. Why are we hoping for that kind of quality in our next Prime Minister?
But also with Donald Trump, you had the same thing about, oh, well, he's just saying this. He doesn't really mean it. Once he gets into power, this won't actually be the case. And it has been precisely the case. And you could argue a lot worse. I think there are obvious differences between Boris Johnson and Donald Trump. But how do we see the first few weeks with Boris Johnson as Prime Minister playing out?
Well, it's interesting because he's becoming Prime Minister in the summer, which is always a very difficult time for political parties historically, because the Labour Party usually has an anti-Semitism crisis now. I mean, it used to do nothing in the summer and get sort of hammered by the government.
We'll come on to that in a second.
And the Conservative Party usually have to deal with sort of foreign policy issues rather than domestic issues because the Parliament doesn't sit. So he's come at a time actually that's quite a sort of flashpoint for someone like Boris Johnson, who is under a lot of scrutiny for his diplomatic relations, particularly with America. So I think that will probably be one of the key themes of his first few weeks as Prime Minister, as well as seeing whether he really is in that hardened no-deal position, because he's going to have to row back from it at some point if he actually doesn't want to take the country in that direction.
But then I think that I've been chatting to a few people who kind of are around Team Boris, and obviously, like, to be clear, this is very much kind of like reshuffle gossip as opposed to like definite information, but the kind of names I've been hearing are sort of like Priti Patel is meant to come back to cabinet, Ian Duncan Smith, James Cleverly, which
Ian
is actually
Duncan
like
Smith.
Ian, yeah, party wow. chairman, I think, is oh, the is yeah, the rumored sure, thing. That. So yeah, Priti, who else had Dominic Raab as well. So that all looks like, you know, that's not a cabinet, I think, that would take kindly to Boris saying, actually, I've changed my mind, let's get another extension because I don't want no deal. So I think it's like he is boxing himself in after watching Theresa May sort of like strangle herself with her own red lines. And clearly he's like, I want exactly some of that. That worked out brilliantly for her. I'm going to box myself in as well, which I didn't quite get.
But then changing from what she did, which was trying to have a balanced cabinet, do you think he's going to have an unbalanced cabinet in terms of he's only going to have people who are signed up to this view of Brexit that he's been...
I mean, who else? Matt peddling. Hancock is going to be so interesting. Like, he's... It's been pathetic sort of like watching him, because I think I was talking about it with some friends, like we were trying to figure out why Matt Hancock specifically has looked so specifically pathetic in this sort of like, you know, election. And I think it's because he's grovelling basically like a PPS. He seems to have forgotten he is actually a cabinet minister. He's actually quite a senior figure now in the Conservative Party. And so he does not need to do, again, you know, what you normally do if you're like the minister for paperclips, who's maybe hoping to become the minister of state for paperclips or something. So, yeah, I'm not sure, you know, someone like him, fine, he is not a massive no-deal Brexiteer, but is he really going to have any sway in a cabinet knowing how he's just behaved?
I really, really do agree with you. He is like a perpetual junior minister, isn't he? Yeah, like even with the jumper and tie combo, that's just so junior minister.
Yeah, when he's actually been, you know, like a cabinet minister for quite a long time under two different prime minister, he did DCMS, health, like he is a senior politician now, but I feel like someone needs to tell him.
Yeah.
Do you think he'll stay at health?
Well, there's a question of who's going to be Boris Johnson's chancellor. I mean,
Yeah, I mean, at the moment, everyone
Liz Truss,
seems to be up
Matt Hancock, Sajid Javid, all of these people with completely different views of how our economy should be run.
So I'm, for what it's worth, I'm hearing Truss again at the moment, which might just be, you know, again, sort of like the chatter in Westminster. But it does seem that that's kind of the main name at the moment. Like, and I feel like I've not heard much about Saj anymore, which I don't know. So, you know, we'll...
But how will this work? Because in his leadership campaign, the only other thing he's saying apart from Brexit is how much money he's going to spend on things. Liz Truss doesn't like spending money on anything. She'd probably take away her civil servants' chairs if she could. Like, how is that going to work? How are they going to marry those two things?
Well, I mean, you could say that at many different levels of the Boris Johnson administration, and indeed in terms of his internal personality as well.
The many contradictions.
And given that he is the walking epitome of cognitive dissonance, I wonder if he sees no issue with that in his cabinet, because it's just the way he is with everything, because he's so contradictory.
But it does seem to be a mess as a sort of like general point. Everyone I've chatted to who's even just like near Team Boris is like, this is a mess. And actually, it is actually even worse than it looks, like from the papers. And like, you know, we kind of read the coverage of what's going on in the background in Team Boris. And actually, it's worse than that. Like, it's more of a mess than that. So I cannot wait. If they can't even run a proper campaign without, you know, sort of like backstabbing and, yeah, general sort of like chaos, how are they going to run number 10? Unclear.
What's really interesting to me is how this then impacts on the polling and what the public think of all of this. Because when
always polls with you, isn't it, Joe?
It is always back to the poll. When he was mayor of London, Boris Johnson received over 50% approval ratings from supporters of all parties. And managing to do that in any political context is really, really impressive. Now, you could argue that the mayor of London's job is not the most party politically demanding of positions. And, you know, you just need to announce a few interesting things and then turn up to a couple of stuff and keep the tube running and you're probably going to be okay. Since he's been back in government, and particularly since he's been back in the cabinet, he did really suffer from a lot of people disapproving, almost as if he wants to, as has been often said, please all of the people all of the time and manages to please nobody. If, as we believe, he is truly a metropolitan liberal at heart, it will be interesting for me to see how that plays with the Conservative heartland, particularly the Conservative members who are, in a lot of cases, far from liberal at heart. How do you play that?
But I'm not sure. I think something we forget as well about Boris Johnson is that he was the editor of The Spectator for quite a long time. And, you know, and if there's anything, you know, like The Spectator does have quite a broad spectrum of all kind of like conservative-minded opinions. Like, it will always have the kind of, again, liberal-ish sort of like metropolitan cuddly stuff, but also properly batshit sort of like fringe opinions. Like, The Spec is kind of known for that. He did manage to do that at the time, so I'm not convinced by this idea that, you know, he would be uncomfortable with the kind of Tory heartland stuff or kind of trying to pander to the right of his party, because he's done that before, like, admittedly as a journalist, but that is something he knows how to do.
Yeah, and the newspaper I think that's most read by Tory members is The Telegraph, which is really the Boris Johnson sort of...
It has wanked itself to death.
The daily,
so
Boris.
I do agree that he definitely knows how to signal to those heartlands. But I mean, I did a bit of reporting at the beginning of the leadership campaign in the sort of bigger Tory associations talking to the grassroots. There was no enthusiasm for Boris Johnson then. There was enthusiasm for a Brexit, a genuine Brexit candidate. So I'm sure that as soon as Dominic Raab was sort of bounced out of the race, then they're reluctantly giving their votes for Boris Johnson. But you're definitely right. There is like a deflation among the Tory grassroots, particularly in the more traditional seats, about Boris Johnson. He was not their first choice, I would say.
Do you think Michael Gove would have won?
I actually think he probably would have done, yeah.
I suspect he would. Well, I suspect it would have been a completely different campaign. We would have seen things very differently.
Less boring. Start.
Yes.
Yeah. Although then he does have a reputation as a backstabber, which is really unpopular among those kind of voters as well. So that might have helped.
I'm
back.
Not sure he would have won, but I think he would have left Boris significantly more wounded.
Yeah.
Like arriving in number 10, or would you like limping and sort of like covered in blood?
We're joined now again by Simon Gentry, who leads the public affairs practice at Newgate. Hello, Simon.
Hi, Joe.
This week, we're going to discuss scooters, and this comes in light of now two reported deaths of scooter riders. The first being in London, Emily Hartridge, the television presenter and YouTube star, who sadly died earlier this week. It strikes me that this is one of those areas where government is just way, way behind the technology. And so How do we move forward with this issue?
Well, as it happens, actually using an electric scooter on the public highway is illegal. You're only allowed to use them on private property. I'm aware that some of the...
So that's roads and pavements?
Roads and pavements. You can only use an electric scooter on private property. They are completely illegal. And I know that some of the companies that would like to get into that market in the UK have been lobbying the government to try and get the law changed. But every time you see people on the streets zipping around, they're illegal. And the fact is, if you've been to Paris recently, where the streets just awash with people going really quickly, 25 kilometres per hour is really fast. They're on and off the pavements all the time. It's quite a terrifying experience, actually.
But actually, it's quite interesting how few of those London has, because I, over the past few months, I've been to Nashville and Malaga, not at the same time. but both of them, I was really struck, because actually they were also completely awash, like all the streets were scooters, and I nearly got run over several times. And it was, oh, that's not really made it to us, one of the biggest cities in the world, like, you know, and somehow Malaga and Nashville.
Yeah, I think it's partly because it's illegal. The other thing that struck me, because I cycle in London a lot, and one of the things that strikes me is the road surface is so bad, and these things have really, really tiny wheels, so it's really, really difficult to navigate and really bump your road when you've got such tiny wheels.
So you don't think there's going to be movement to legalise them? Will there be movement to clamp down on them? Because, you see them, and the electronic... I mean, they're called hoverboards, but any fan of Back to the Future knows that. That's simply not an adequate description. But also electronic skateboards as well. You do see them zooming around, particularly down here on the South Bank, where it is that sort of interesting mix of cycle path and pavement and road. So do you think we'll see police confiscating these things, or will they turn a blind eye?
That'd be so satisfying. So I hate all the smug pricks on all those like fancy things. It'd be great.
I could imagine, at the moment you see people without any helmets, although apparently in Paris there's sort of guidance you have to ride them with a helmet. Plenty of people don't ride with helmets. How are they going to check? So I think there has to be some kind of control put on it. When I started cycling in London about 10 years ago, there was very different cycling culture. And maybe what it is building up a kind of a culture of how you use these things and where you use these things. And zipping through people at 25 kilometres per hour on a pavement is an inappropriate use of it. But perhaps if it was an open stretch of road or something, it would be more appropriate.
And then, of course, there's a question about e-bikes as well. There are a number of companies around London, and I think other cities as well, or certainly hoping to expand to those, that provide electronically powered bikes that look, for all intents and purposes, just like normal pedal bikes, but similarly can really go some.
Well, they're all cheating. I mean, that's the point. As a normal cyclist, they're all bloody cheating.
Yes, but of course, it has been widely reported that data on this shows that the people who are cycling, traditional cycling, tend to be of a relatively narrow demographic. It's not all middle-aged white men in Lycra, but that does make up a lot of it. If e-bikes bring more people to cycling the cycle paths, is that a good thing?
You know, I personally think it's a really good thing, but there've got to be rules, and people've got to kind of understand what those rules are so that we can all get along on the shared space.
Marie, I have a sense you have a view on this.
So, of course, I have a view on this. And my view is that I quite like cycling, but I'm quite a slow cyclist because, you know, there's no rush. You know, I can just enjoy cycling.
Fundamentally disagree. Well, are you on Strava?
But anyway, as a half serious point, I do find cycling quite dangerous in London, very stressful because of the other cyclists, not because of the cars, of the amount of sort of like pricks who just like go past me because clearly they want to go very, very fast because they're very insecure. If I could get one of those stupid bikes that makes me go faster, I would just zip past all of those pricks and it would be great. That's my opinion.
Boris Johnson was a big fan of cycling and cycle paths.
Still is, yep.
If he were to become Prime Minister, as looks virtually certain, do you think this would be a priority for him?
I think cycling generally is something that he's fond of. I think it's an incredibly effective way of getting around modern city. Yes, I think he'd be interested and open to this area, but whether they'll legalise scooters, I think that's a very open question.
And so if you were looking for a gift this Christmas for those listeners downloading this later in the year, would you be looking to buy an e-scooter?
No.
Simon Gentry, thank you.
Thank you.
But of course, it's not just the Conservatives that are deeply divided and arguing among themselves. Labour haven't had a great time of it recently. We continue to have this strange situation in the polls of effectively what is now a four-way race, with the Conservatives and Labour battling it out with the Brexit Party and the Liberal Democrats. Usually, when one of the two major parties suffers, you expect the other one to do well. That's what's historically been the case. And yet, this time around, as with so many things recently, things are very different.
It's 2019. Everyone loses.
Yes, yeah, we are in so many ways all losers. Labour recently has had a newspaper advert published, signed by various, admittedly many of them long-term opponents of Jeremy Corbyn, talking about his difficulties with anti-Semitism. This is the problem that refuses to go away. Is there now anything that Jeremy Corbyn can do to actually convince people that progress is being made?
I don't think there's anything he can do now. I think it would be too little too late. It would look like he'd been dragged kicking and screaming into doing anything. And I think that the enmity has been established now. The leadership feel like they're under attack. They feel like some of the attacks are smears. The people who feel victims of the anti-Semitism feel like it hasn't been dealt with properly and that it's never going to be taken seriously. I do think it's irreconcilable now. But what it also shows, like this letter in such a Labour protest, a strongly worded advert in The Guardian, signed by 60-plus peers.
That'll show.
You know, not even an op-ed. Yeah. I mean, come on, guys, pitch a piece. But anyway, you know, it shows how powerless they are. It's actually quite sad. Like, if you have to protest against your own party leader in a newspaper because that's the only place you're going to get your voice heard because, you know, behind closed doors you haven't managed to come to some sort of consensus, it shows that they're powerless, and probably it shows that the leadership are powerless in trying to please them or trying to placate them. So I do think it's irreconcilable, and the Labour MPs who have left over it, you know, will there be more to follow? If there aren't, then, you know, that means that the leadership have sort of got away with the approach that they've taken towards the crisis, and they'll carry on sort of as a divided party, which is never good in polling, as you know.
Panorama broadcast a controversial episode about Labour anti-Semitism last week. To my mind, there wasn't much in the way of new information in there, but obviously the whistleblowers, who their numbers have now swelled, obviously this doesn't help the party or the narrative.
I get the thing about the Panorama episode, obviously we kind of like talked about it a lot, and you know, they kind of like sides were taken, arguments were had, but do you think it actually changed anyone's mind kind of that late into the civil war?
I don't think so. I mean, it comes back to what I was saying before about how I don't think the two sides can be reconciled, because the more people from the Labour Party whistleblow or criticise the leadership publicly, the more people on the leadership side will say, well, they were against Jeremy Corbyn from the start. You know, the party was institutionally anti-Corbyn, and, you know, maybe we should have purged the party machinery before he properly took power, and those sort of arguments. The leadership obviously, you know, is sympathetic to the issues, but feels under attack with programmes like this and feels like it's a sort of an unfair way to sort of arbitrate the party's differences on telly in a programme that it's accused of being inaccurate. It's never a good look for a political party to be at war with the press or with the media, with the BBC. But actually for Jeremy Corbyn, that can sometimes help his cause among his supporters. So, you know, if the Labour Party is not doing well in the polls, or if it's being attacked by its own members or by its own MPs, then Jeremy Corbyn's excuse can always be, well, you know, it's the press are against me. Journalists aren't giving me a fair hearing. And quite a lot of that kind of narrative, that sort of populist narrative, helped him, I think, in the 2017 election.
But isn't it, in that particular case, I did think they played it slightly weirdly of kind of trying to, but you're complaining about the documentary before it was even aired.
Mm.
So I think that, you know, you can't really do that. Surely, I mean, even from a purely cynical point of view, what you do is that, okay, you know, we have faith in the BBC, we think this will be covered fairly, we look forward to watching it, and blah blah blah, and then it airs, and then you go, God, you know, we are so disappointed, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, surely from the basic sort of,
yeah it was a very unclassy way to approach the fact that the documentary was happening, which shows that they feel like they're under siege all the time. And that feeling, that sort of wounded feeling, is never going to be a welcoming attitude to the people who feel like they've been victimised in the party. So I just don't think there's any way that they can go forward from here in unity.
And speaking of problems with unity, Labour continues to have an issue around Brexit and Leave and Remain.
I am loving the new plot twist of like 10 Labour MPs saying, we would vote for no deal, but also who did not vote for the withdrawal agreement as well, which is, you know, one of the things that I find maddening in politics. But was it Sarah Champion, I think, the other day, kind of doing an interview and saying, well, you know, you have to say, you know, on television, you know, which is public, which other people can watch, kind of saying, you know, and obviously, but that's the thing, you know, if we don't say we would have no deal, then they may offer us a bad deal or, you know, something along those lines. And, you know, I play poker, you know, it's how it works. Like, but the thing with poker is that, you know, if you're bluffing, you don't say, and now I shall bluff. And admittedly, I've not played a lot of poker in my life, but that's not my vision of poker.
To be fair to her, she was putting a label on exactly what all MPs' calculations have been. Not all of them. Some of them have been acting out of principle. She was just saying how we've got into this mess. It's because Theresa May, MPs, the Labour Party, they were all playing their own version of poker with each other, with the opposition, with the EU, trying to see who would blink first. And obviously, it's Britain who is going to have to blink first and accept a no-deal exit because they're the ones who stand to lose.
In that case, why not vote for the deal? Especially, I think, people like Sarah Champion, who said, if I remember correctly, he wouldn't vote for the withdrawal agreement because like there wasn't enough guarantees on workers' rights and stuff. And it's like, but no deal is fine?
Yeah, I know. I thought that was a really, really...
I do wonder if it's playing to the one third of Labour voters who did vote Leave and hoping to appeal to them in a geographically narrow manner. I happen to think that shows a misunderstanding of the data, but people like Sarah Champion wouldn't be the first people to misunderstand the data around Brexit.
Yeah, yeah. And also, you've got to look at their constituencies as well. So if they want a chance of a job, then, you know, I've been to these places and interviewed some of these Leave supporting MPs who are campaigning or who represent Leave seats. They don't have a choice because literally, you know, the people that they talk to every day are telling, not only telling them that they want Labour to honour the referendum result, they're saying we want a no deal Brexit. But that's really difficult as an MP to hear every day.
But there is a lot of data to show that even in those constituencies, that yes, a vote for Remain or among either the MP or the party more generally would lose some votes, but it would still maintain enough Labour votes so that in those areas, yes, the constituency may be Leave supporting, but the Labour voters within that constituency are Remain supporting. And so they can hold on. And so a shift to Remain might lose you some votes, but it wouldn't necessarily lose you many seats. That's what the data is showing. But of course, the data is based on what the situation is at the moment, not what the situation might be when the general election takes place.
Yeah, and of course, if you're a Labour MP in one of these traditional Leave voting seats, then there's no sort of history of the Lib Dems threatening you there.
Yeah.
So it might be that they've got this idea that they have to pander to the voters in the seats who want Brexit because they take the Labour vote for granted.
And the people they see in the street coming up to them will be the pro
exactly.
Leave
they
people,
will be the louder voices.
They won't necessarily be the Labour supporters.
That's true.
So it is a very complicated situation.
So I'm just eye-rolling a lot. But I don't know, I feel I'm going to sound like some sort of like cringe FVP person saying this. But I don't know, I feel like, you know, it is obviously entirely fine, even if you're a Remain supporting MP, to say, actually, you know, most of my constituents actually want, like, you know, quite a hard Brexit. Therefore, you know, that's kind of what I'm going to be gunning for from now on. But with no deal, I don't really understand MPs who will just sit there and say, well, you know, my constituents want that, therefore. Like, it is something that would, specifically, I think, to Leave voting poorer communities, like, that will make those communities effectively worse. And, you know, the reasons why they voted Leave, the fact that they felt they were left behind, the quality of public services, etc., that will get worse if there's a no-deal Brexit. And so just grow a fucking spine. Like, you know, say, obviously, you know, I hear you, I'm your MP, etc., I'm representing you. I will be, you know, kind of arguing for a hard Brexit, even though that's not what I personally wanted. But the whole no deal, like pandering to no deal Brexit supporters, I find completely maddening.
I think the difficulty for them is that in a lot of these places, people have been living really difficult lives anyway. So that argument is really hard to make. It's really hard to say no deal will make things worse when people are saying, how can it get any worse? I'm pissed off with the status quo, which I think is a big problem for a lot of the Labour MPs who represent seats like in the Northeast and places like that. It's difficult to get traction for that argument, especially when you can't imagine what no deal would be like. I'm not defending it. I'm just saying.
I'm not saying it's an easy thing to do, but also I just get frustrated, I guess.
Yeah.
And so maybe that leaves room for a new party to come into the fray. Anoush, how are Change UK and the new independents and everything else going?
What are they called now? The Independent Group for Change, is that right?
No, isn't it? So there's that, but there's also the Independents.
Oh yeah,
I
the
think.
Independents.
And then there are people
the
who, and then there's Sarah Wollaston, who has chosen to be an independent, but separate from the independent.
And there's also Nick Bowles, who's a Conservative supporting independent.
So I'm glad we cleared that up. I just want to touch on the sad news that this week sees the last episode of Political Show This Week broadcast. That means that if we haven't been on the show yet, it's very unlikely that we will be able to dress up like a cowboy and then sing a song in front of a fairground during the opening credits. Anoush, have you ever appeared on...
I never have, and now I never will.
I have something to confess, which is that I've not only never appeared on This Week, I have never watched This Week.
Well, that means you have but this week to tune in.
I've walked into that, Jesus. Yeah.
So perhaps you and I can discuss the final episode next week.
I will also not be watching it.
But this might be why it's ending.
do you think there's room for a light-hearted look at politics at the moment, or is it just
maybe one that's actually
miserable?
Funny?
Yeah, I think a lot of people do.
We're never getting commissioned if you carry on.
I think people do say, like, you know, political satire is dead in this kind of age, but I do think it's just because a lot of it isn't funny at the moment.
Actually, I think that Twitter specifically has been quite bad for all these shows. Like, Have I Got News For You, I think, has suffered massively from Twitter. I used to watch it quite a lot a few years ago, and then I couldn't exactly pinpoint when that happened, but there was definitely a point when I watched an episode and I was like, oh, they're all making jokes I heard on Twitter five days ago, and they're all slightly less funny. But also, you know, I've seen those jokes, so I think that there's only a finite amount of jokes you can make about certain political events, and Twitter makes them within the first of like 10 minutes of an event happening. So I'm not entirely... I think you need to be a lot cleverer now to be funny about politics, especially in a weekly format.
Yeah.
And we've not really figured out how to do that yet.
And finally then, it's the anniversary of the moon landings this week. And so I'd like to ask you, Anoush, what percentage of the British people do you think believe that the moon landings in the 60s and 70s were a hoax and that no astronauts have ever landed on the moon?
9%?
Anoush says 9. MLC, what's your...
I was going to say 8, but also can I talk about my personal conspiracy theory?
Please
which
do.
I love. There is a website, by the way, you know, like, hopefully we can tweet it out. It is one of my favourite websites in the world. The URL is jfkistrappedinthemoon.com.
Wow, and that combines two of the greatest.
Oh, yes, so JFK did not die. He just got trapped, not on the moon, in the moon.
Anyone who's seen Iron Sky, the sci-fi film about Nazis who went to the moon in 1945 and then in the 21st century came back, will know that there's precedent for this.
I'm going to say 8%.
8%. The true figure for the percentage of people that say that statement is true is 21%. In five people, when Delta Poll tested this last year, the statement was the moon landings in the 60s and 70s were a hoax. No astronauts have ever landed on the moon. 21% of British people said that was true.
Once again, ban the general public.
Compared to 24% of Americans and 19% of the French.
Woo! We are slightly less thick.
the country with the lowest figure that we tested was Canada, but they're obviously very polite. So yes, one in five, more than one in five in Britain believes it didn't happen.
Maybe we deserve
it. It makes
Boris.
You not want to cover elections at all, doesn't it?
It's a remarkable figure. Okay, that's all for this week. Anoush, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you to Newgate and Simon Gentry. We will see you next week. Please remember to like, subscribe, review, all these different things that help people hear about us. And do tell all of your friends and many of the people that you don't know, even if you haven't enjoyed the podcast. This is a Poddo podcast produced by Nick Hilton, and our theme tune is by Joe Button.
For more details, go to podopods.com, and for sales and advertising, email nick@podopods.com.
And yes, that's spelled podopods.com.